Okay, good morning, everyone. As I mentioned to you last week, today we have a very special treat and a very special opportunity. We're going to have a shiur from Rabbi Chaim Jachter. I first got to know Rabbi Jachter not in person, but by reading his sfarim on halacha and his posts, which were part of the TABC publications, and anyone who reads them will know that Rabbi Jachter is not just a tremendous Talmud Chacham and Posek and Dayan, but someone who has incredible clarity and is able to present things in a way that allows anyone reading or listening to both understand the complexity, but also come away with clear-cut conclusions and leave with understanding and not confusion. And what I thought was fascinating is a number of years ago, I started seeing shiurim on matters of emuna. And then about 3 years ago, I think, he published a book called Reason to Believe, Rational Explanations of Orthodox Jewish Faith. And this book is an incredible book. I have a copy, and I recommend everyone to consider getting one. And we're going to hear a lot about it, but I think I'll let Rabbi Jachter explain. I apologize for a little bit of the background noise. My kids are on vacation this week as well. So Rabbi Jachter uses that same type of clarity to address issues of emuna, and specifically how to answer some of the most, the most basic questions of emuna, the questions that everybody wonders about. Some people wonder about them because they have these questions. If you don't wonder about them because you have the questions, certainly people who, like you guys who are going into chinuch or rabbanim, so they're likely going to be asked these questions. So even if you in particular aren't necessarily troubled by them, you have no sveikos in your emuna, you have to know how to answer these questions. And besides that, having chizuk and emuna is always a good thing. So in that light, it's really a tremendous chus to have Rabbi Jachter here with us today. And as you could see from the source sheet, which I think you should all have, you're going to see how he addresses many of the questions that you're certainly going to get. I want you to all feel free to participate, to ask questions during and after this year. And without, I guess, any further ado, it's a tremendous, tremendous chus for us to have Rabbi Jachter. So I'm going to turn it over to you, and thank you so much for participating, for teaching us.
Thank you, Rabbi Weirblank, for your very, very kind introduction, and thank you all of you, every single one of you, for joining us. It's a big chus to teach you guys. You know, I'm looking at all you guys. You guys are the future. You know, they're just the future of Klal Yisrael, and it's a schus. Just to look at you guys is just really a schus. Now, I just before I begin, just a special shout out to the TABC Talmidim. It's good to see it's good to see Zach and Ezra and Joe. It's really great to see you all. Okay, so let me start out disagreeing with Rabbi Weiderblank right away. I'm going to disagree with him about one thing. He said, you're going to walk away with a lot of answers. I don't think so. Yeah, I think you're going to walk away. If I'm at least successful, I want you to walk away with more questions. Now, not so much questions in Emuna, but questions in Chinuch and Rabbanus. And that's kind of like, I want to have more of a conversation. I don't want to just come in here like someone has all the answers, because I don't think that I have, I just do not think that I have all the answers over here. I just don't. So I'm going to try to raise some of my questions that I have. And this is not so much going to be a talk about or chizuk and emunah, and that you get from every week from Rabbi Wiederblank. But really, what this is more of like a strategy how to deal with as machanech, as strategies as a rav of a shul, to figure out how to what's the most effective ways to present. And I don't have all the answers. Even being in chinuch for 35 years and rabbanus for 20 years, I don't have all the answers. But hopefully we'll discuss and maybe we'll get at least some perspectives over here. Now, when I look back at my chinuch, I think I had an excellent chinuch. I had the opportunity to learn with many great rabbanim, with both Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Schechter, Rav Willig, unbelievable rabbanim that I had the schus to learn with. And I'll tell you that I did not have, when I look back and think, did I have anybody? Did I have anybody that in any one moment that where there's a discussion of emunah? I don't think so. I don't even think there was 1 minute in shiur in which we in any of the shiurim that I had in any level, formal or informal, where we had such a conversation. I just don't remember any. I don't think we had anyone. And so the question is why? It's funny. I'm starting out this shiur, or this discussion actually, talking about why we shouldn't be having this discussion. So let me show you reason why you shouldn't have this discussion. I think Rabbi Wiederblank does that in one of his svarim, right? About Olam Haba. Yeah, why we shouldn't have this discussion. So let's talk about why we shouldn't have this discussion. Gentlemen, let me ask you this. You look in all of Gemara and all of Shas. Where do you find in the Gemara that they talk about Raya's that Torah min Hashemayim? Can anybody answer that question? Where do you find it anywhere in the Gemara? Yes, Ellie.
In Bava Metzia, at the end of Zav.
So you'll have a little bit. You have in Chulin, you know, Raya min Hashemayim minayin. You have a little bit. You have a little bit. But it's in drips and drabs. It's not done in an organized way, and it's not presented in a you know, you don't have any Maseches Emunah. You just don't. It's 99% of the Gemara is not about Chizuk Emunah. Here and there, there's a little something, but it's not. That's not the focus. So the question is why. And I think there's a simple answer. I think it's a simple answer. I think the real authentic emunah is going to come from the Ma'or of Torah. The Medrash gives it. The Medrash in Eicha tells us that Ma'or Shabbat Makarvin L'Makom. The light within Torah brings you to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's a really authentic way of connecting to Torah and really buying into Torah, is trying to show day in and day out, nonstop, revealing the Ma'or of Torah, and that itself is the best proof. That's the evidence. That's what builds your emunah. Give me an example. One of my colleagues at TABC, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a lot of insights, Rabbi Rafi Mandelstam, he said to me, you know, like sitting in Rabbi Rosenzweig's shiur, and then like he raises all these problems, and then solves the problems, ties all the sugis together. It's, oh my goodness, you know, he said, it's like being in Mama Har Sinai. And the truth is, I felt that also learning with Rav Lichtenstein. He sat in a shiur klali for 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours. At the end of the shiur, you know, the Ma'or Shabbat. Oh my goodness! It was like Har Sinai. It was unbelievable. Such amkus. And I would say the same thing. I would say the same, you know, you can still capture this. You know, go to the Shiur Mazecher Abba Marizal. You'll see those Shiur, unbelievable, unbelievable Ma'or Shaba as being Ma'arvan L'makom. And I just want to add to this, again, continuing on why we shouldn't have this discussion. You know, it's interesting. If you've read the Rav's The Lonely Man of Faith, you know that the Rav presents a tremendously effective way of responding to biblical criticism. The biblical criticism, the Apikoros approach to Bereishis Perek Aleph and Bereishis Perek Bet. Tremendous. So people have said, that I don't understand, why did the Rav only present a response to biblical criticism on one issue? He did such a great job of smashing the biblical criticism to Bereishis Perek Aleph, Bereishis Perek Bet. Why didn't he do more? Rav Breuer asked that. Why did he write more? So the answer that I would suggest to you is that I think from the Rav's perspective, he said what's going to convince you is not my responses of the biblical criticisms, because then you'll be start to think about, well, am I giving a better answer? Are they giving the better answer? You'll be stuck in a cycle forever. Oh, are the traditionalists right? The non-traditionalists right? I have one of the students in TBC like that. He just focuses on the on these, you know, like on my book, on There's Reason to Believe, you know, and books like it, and the responses, the Orthodox responses to the atheist challenge, the biblical criticism challenges, and other challenges, and he's stuck. He's like, goes back and forth. Are the traditionalists right? Are the secularists right? Back and forth. That's not the way to do it. The key way to come to Torah is the Ma'or Shaba is Makarvan L'makom. So ultimately, I begin this conversation by saying we shouldn't be even having this conversation. Well, you know, so what should we do? Should we now just, you know, just go to the gym or something like that? You know, it's like so the shiur is over. I'm supposed to speak for an hour. So why are we having this? I just spoke for 10 minutes, 5 minutes. What's going on here? So despite the fact that it's what we're doing here is really, so to speak, not necessary, I think we do have a mandate to know how to respond. You know, we have a mission we all know in Pirkei Avos, Da Malahashiv. We also know that we have to be, as the Torah tells, we saw so many times in last week's parasha, Kish Alcha Bin Chala Lemor, right? When your son asks you, right, you know, you have to be ready for a, you have to be ready for a response. I'm just going to share with you two exchanges that were in the past where I got to tell you that two exchanges in my rabbinic career, one from 1990 and one from 2007, from my chinuch career actually, where I was posed questions and I had no response. So at the beginning of my teaching, my chinuch career, I was teaching women. So here's the question: Here's a woman posed the following question to me. She's a grandmother by now. Interesting. She said to me, "Why do I believe?" Why do I believe? So my response was basically, I see the Ma'or Shaba. You know, I see the light in it. Yeah. Okay. So, but then she said, yeah, but the Christian sees the light in what they're doing. And so does the Muslim and every other religion, the people who are committed to it. You know, why should I believe that Judaism is superior over Christianity or Islam or all these other religions? So do you have any responses? I had no response at that time. I had zero response because I'd spent no time in developing my emuna and working on these points. I just, you know, the question they always ask, is Emunah taught or is Emunah caught? So I caught it. I caught the Emunah from my Rebbeim. I give credit to my mother, a tremendous, tremendous amount of credit to my mother. I caught it. Well, now that I'm in a position to teach it, yeah, people are asking me, Kishalcha Bimcha, I didn't have an answer. So what here? I'm asking you, all a bunch of smicha guys. Anybody have an answer? Jacob, yes, or Yaakov?
Yes, I think like maybe the answer would be like national revelation. Like no other religion can claim national revelation that all, you know, 6 million people saw the same exact thing and it was all transmitted, you know, without any differences all the way till today. So the Muslims and the Christians can't claim that or never tried to.
Okay, so how many agree with that answer? Do I get some hands? Some like it, some don't like it. Yeah, I think, you know, okay. So I will say like this, that it's important that you develop 30-second answers. By the way, who do we learn that you need to have sound bites? Who in the Gemara teaches us sound bite answers? That's today. Everyone's into sound bite answers. Don't bother me with the long, detailed answers. But you have to know how to be, these responses to be mechudad and beficha. You know, you need to be able to get it out quick. Who do we learn that from, that you have to give be able to super quick answers? Yeah, who do we learn it from? Anyone give it a shot? Hillel, regalachas. You have to know regalachas to be able to give an answer. So, you know, we could talk. I see we have a little dissent about this, about the Kuzari's point, which I'm sure you do a lot with where Rabbi Wiederblank. There's a lot, and I have to look out for your new sefer here. It's on delivery for my son. There's a lot to be said for that. Okay, it's a great answer. At the very least for the 30 seconds, as a 30-second answer, a regalachas answer, it's a great answer. Whether it stands up to scrutiny, you know, okay, we could discuss that. I think there's more to be said. But for 30 seconds, I think that's excellent. Yes, our good friend Jeremy, yes.
I don't think I understand the question. The question is, why do you believe? Believe what?
Why do I believe the Torah is from Sinai? Why do I believe in all this? In other words, I'm keeping the Torah because I believe that God commanded me. Well, why do I believe that God commanded me? So my answer was, yeah, because the Ma'or Sheba, Makavr and the Makam. I'm just intuitively, this is, I saw the Ma'or. I saw the Ma'or, right? This is where she was coming from. So I'm just trying to show you with here that I think we need to be able to be prepared to give some kind of answers, at least 30-second answers, at least to be able to give some kind of answers. Here, let me give you another one. Here I have, and I'm just changing the name. It's not, I'm not going to say who the name, I don't want to take away from people's privacy, but we'll call him Moshe. Moshe graduated TABC. And the year after he graduated TABC, very, very well accomplished Talmud. He was learning in the yeshiva in Israel. And he composed what he called the Kuntras HaSvekos. Play on the Ksosis Kuntras HaSvekos, but about a 15-page long series of questions that he had. That was a pretty serious Kuntras HaSvekos that he had. And I got to tell you that, I mean, some of the questions were more compelling than the others, but I got to tell you, you know, I didn't have much of an answer for a lot of them. I didn't have much of an answer because I didn't develop this side of the moon. I just relied on the Ma'or Sheba, Makarv, and Lamakam. I caught it. Well, now I have to teach it. Here, let me give you one sample question. That just, hey, Kishalcha bin Chalemor, here. He asks, well, one second, why should I believe that the Mabul happened if there's no geological evidence for the Mabul? Yeah? So let's get some from our good friend Zach Orenstein. Yeah, here we go. Zach, yeah, so what's your response to that? What's your response for that? What could I have said to him? I had no idea. I never heard such an issue like that. But anyway, yes, go ahead, Zach.
Well, I think a lot of these times people are more confident about historical evidence than they really should be. Like, I think in the case of the Mabul, like, I read historians say there is evidence for a large flood, even if it wasn't the whole world. And there are plenty of Rabbanim. I've heard a few prominent Rabbanim say that flood didn't have to be the entire world, according to Armuno. So, you know.
Okay, there's a lot to discuss for that. I'll just give you an answer. The 30-second answer that I give now is something that is from Dr. Schroeder. Dr. Gerald Schroeder, if you've seen some of his books, he writes you don't necessarily have to agree with everything that he says, but it's certainly worth looking into. So Dr. Schroeder he points out that the Mabu was too short to leave a geological imprint. That was so there you have, there's a 30-second response. Again, there's more to discuss, but there's at least some kind of a response to be, because if we don't have responses, it's not good. Or at least to have, if you can't respond right away, at least to have some sort of a source to be able to get back quickly. Well, let me look into that and respond. Yes, our Moshe, yes.
I'm confused. If you're admitting that you can't really have a 30-second answer, then how is giving a 30-second answer helpful?
So that's a Beis Shammai. That's a Beis Shammai response, which is a lot of value. He said, "Wow, what do you mean to the whole Kol HaTorah Kula Regel Achas?" But I think that's but nonetheless, Hillel's showing us that sometimes the 30-second answers, even though there's a lot more to discuss, I think sometimes you'd be able to. It's worthwhile giving a 30-second discussion, even though there's a lot. You could say that there's a lot more to discuss, but I'll give you a regal acha. As long as you put that caveat, that's a 30-second answer. I think that's good. Just like we asked the halachic shaila. Now, yeah, it's a big topic. There's a lot to discuss, but our regal achas, here's an answer. Yes, Jacob.
Yeah, I'm not so sure how people would respond, would like this response, but I've definitely heard this before, that the Torah is not a science textbook. And you know, it's more so, I guess, in the soundbite answer, it's more so a guide for life. And if you want to know the science behind it, the mechanics behind how everything came to be, that's not meant to be found here, but we're meant to learn something from the story of the Mabul.
Okay, that's a very legitimate point. What I would just add is add a little bit more sophistication. Something that I learned from someone that I really gained a lot from, and that is Dr. Jeremy England. Anybody ever hear of Dr. Jeremy England? So he is he was a physics professor at MIT, and now he's moved on to private industry, and he's one of the world's top physicists. And he did not grow up religious, but he became religious, and on pretty much on his own, and he became a pretty solid Talmid Chacham. He even got online smicha. Not that I'm recommending online smicha, but that was for him was very, very appropriate. And so he likes to point out. He said, you know what? There are many languages. There are many ways of capturing MS, and he said science is one way of capturing an MS, and Torah is another way of capturing MS. It's a different language, so it's a very interesting way to a very interesting approach. He just came out with a new book where he Every Life on Fire, how thermodynamics explains the origin of the world, and he throws a lot of Torah in there. So it's a very interesting voice for you to be aware of. So it's you know, to take that idea you're saying, Jacob, and just to make it a little more sophisticated, I think that would be helpful. Yes, Tyler. Yes, shout out to T-Neck. Yes, Country Club.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Thank you for remembering. That's pretty cool.
Yes.
Everyone forgets about us. I was going to say, I heard an answer once from Rav Mendel Blachman. I don't want to butcher it, but I think it was that we live a life based off probability. So when you go through the logic of the Torah coming into existence and being emes, you can kind of give a probability answer in a sense that's emistic.
That's interesting. But I don't know, you know, it doesn't, you'll forgive me. I know I'm Fodo, you know, Rav Blachman Kvodo,
I'm probably misquoting him. I don't want to. It's probably me misquoting him in some way.
Uh huh. Okay. You know, but I would, I'm a ani mamin be'emuna shalema, you know, but that doesn't mean, again, there's a lot more to discuss, I'm sure you do with Rabbi Wiederblank, that ani mamin be'emuna shalema, just like ani mamin be'emuna shalema, that my wife is the perfect woman for me, even though I can't prove it, you know, necessarily, and ani mamin that, that you exist, even though I can't prove it, you know, you study philosophy and you see, well, maybe, you know, Descartes, that maybe I'm being, maybe an evil demon is fooling me, you know, but nonetheless, I still, I'm mamin that you exist with Muna Shlema. I'm also mamin be'muna Shlema. So, yeah, I hear what he's saying about probability. You know, I think maybe what he might be saying is that the way we function is we don't function with absolute proofs because you can't prove anything. We make all the important decisions in life based on intuitions, like we're saying the Ma'or Sheba, Makarim Lamakom. But nonetheless, I think we should be able, we're going to still, us. So I still think that we should be able to, we have the ability to respond, and we have ability to build on our Amuna, that it just should not just be intuition. So let's, so therefore the bottom line is like this. I think my strong opinion to all of you is you all need to be, however you deal with it, is you all need to prepare yourself how to answer. Now, I would say, now maybe you say you can get away with it in a school. You know, in a school, as long as you have one person on staff, oh, you know, ask so-and-so, ask Rabbi so-and-so, he'll give you an answer for this. But, you know, maybe you can get away with it in a school like that. But if you're a Rav of a shul, and you don't necessarily have answers, I'm not sure if that's going to work. You know, you can always say I'll get back to you, but you should be able to get back very, very quickly if you don't have answers. I don't know. I think you got to speak, you know, part of what definition of Talmud Chacham is, you know, shol b'chol malkom u'meishiv. You know, you should be able to answer. So I would say just to take the time to be able to be prepared yourself to give these answers. And there's not a ton of time. I think there's a couple of books that at least will give you decent answers to be able to respond. Okay. Now just give me an example. I know we can really pay a big price for not having answers. I'll give you one example. One more example that we said, you know, I'm sorry to give free advertising to Tapi Korsis, but you'll forgive me for doing this. There's a book written by Shulam Dean. This guy was Hasidish, and he left it. You know, and he write, and I started reading through the read. I was at a relative's house for Shabbos, and they had they had the books. I looked at it. Give me some good ammunition on the other side. So yeah, it did give me a lot of good ammunition. I saw the reasons why he's giving for being secular. I said, oh my goodness, that's pretty pathetic. One of the things he wrote was, there's no evidence for the Israelite kingdom. There's no, for Malchus Yisrael. There was no evidence for Malchus Yisrael. That's crazy. There's no archaeological evidence. First of all, it's just factually wrong. There's a Tel Dan stele, there's a Mesha stele. You don't need to be, you don't have to be a genius to be able to know that. That's just, it's pretty ABCs of biblical archaeology. I once had, in the days on a little bit more response, somebody came to me for a get, and when he was writing the get, and it was from the wife, he was asking me about, a Haredi who lost his faith. So I was saying, well, didn't Yoshiyahu doesn't the Psukim say that Yoshiyahu introduced all of Sefer Dvarim to us? You know, I said, no, that's not what it says. And I said to him, and again, I'm giving a 30-second soundbite over here, but what my response was to him at that moment, as I said to him, is that Yoshio wasn't able to convince us to leave Avodah Zarah. What's the best proof to that? 22 years after he was killed in battle, we had the Korban. It's See me. He couldn't convince the world. He couldn't convince Bnei Yisrael to abandon Avodah Zarah, and we. And you're going to tell me he introduced a new sefer to the Torah and we accepted it? Hard. I can't buy that. It's utterly ridiculous. I mean, one of the things that I like to emphasize when I speak to people is I say to them that I am. I think that the religious explanations are far more reasonable than the secular explanations of life, of Torah. Ours is much greater than theirs. But now, okay, so Adkan. So far, what I'm saying is that I think it's important for us, as Rabbi Wiederbrunk has said at the beginning, da malahashi. You need to know how to respond. And if you don't know how to respond, it's a problem. I think in the Shulam Deen book, I don't know if it's true, but he said that he kept on asking questions and nobody gave him answers. So I think we really need to be able to know how to respond. Okay, but here's the big question as I'm saying at the beginning of the our talk that I wasn't sure, you know, as I'm going to raise more questions and answers. The big question I have over here is that, well, it's not easy to, and the question is like this. One thing, da malahashiv, to respond to questions. But however, is it worth proactively addressing amuna questions in the classroom or in the shul? I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about it. I'll raise you some of the considerations. On one hand, you know, but if you're going to be responding, well, then you're going to be teaching people about apikorsis, right? Here's a response to what the apikorsis say. But you know what you're doing by doing that. You're teaching them the apikorsis. You know, so what are you accomplishing? What are you accomplishing by doing that? It's like in hockey, you know, it's like shooting the puck into your own net. You know, it's problematic. But on the other hand, if you compare, you know, when I was growing up to now, you can't compare the situation. If somebody wanted to know about biblical criticism when I was growing up, you had to go to a library, probably a bigger library, not your ordinary neighborhood library. Go to a library, take out some of these dusty tomes on biblical criticism, and you wouldn't. And who's going to be looking into it? It'd be difficult to be able to understand. But now, just go on the internet. You go online on Wikipedia, and there you have it. You have short, brief explanations. So you know. So for example, when I had students that asked me, Rabbi, we heard there's no evidence for no archaeological evidence for Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yeah. Then, Rabbi, what's your response to that? Okay. So he wouldn't, I don't think the students very few people growing up in the 1980s would be fortified with these questions. But today the information is so readily available. So it may be important for the students to see, oh, you know what? My Rebbe dealt with it. I'm not worried about these questions. You know, we had a whole discussion. We have, I know at Nativ, I don't know if some of you went to Nativ. Nativ has their Amuna Day. So is it worth having Amuna Days in your school? Is it worth having it in shul? Is it worth having it in, is it worth having it in YU? I don't know if YU has. We'll have a Amuna Day. No, we're just gonna talk about Amuna. Why you didn't have it in my day? Something tells me they still don't have it. But that's the question. It's a question you have to decide. That question also you have to decide. You have to figure out: is it better to wait till age 18, or is it worth dealing with it on a high school level? See, if it in the high school and at high school age with teenagers, they tend to be more. Teenagers tend to be more skeptical. So the question is if you're going to be raising these issues at a rebellious age, they won't be receptive to what they're saying. On the other hand, if they raise the questions and you're responding, they'll be much more receptive. So, you know, it's, yeah, you have to get, they have to be in a psychological place where they're ready to hear the answer. So, but we realize also something else. Many, many, many Orthodox people, I don't care if it's modern Orthodox or Haredi, many people's emuna is very, very shallow. And there are, so, you know, to quote Eliyahu HaNavi, you know, they're poseach al shnei asifin. You know, they don't know if they believe emuna shleiman. Sometimes they'll even express it. Is there a need? Yes. It's kind of like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, you know, Yochanan ben Zakkai in the Mishnah in Kalim, the Gemara Baba Basra quotes it. You know, it's like, oilim omer, oilim olo omer. I lose if I talk about it, potentially, but I lose if I don't talk about it. So I don't have the easy answers. I will share with you that sometimes what I find works was that I have these with the students. We have Friday talks. So they're usually they're most effective when it's in response to student questions. So an example. So a student asked me, you know, okay, could we talk this Friday about why you believe? Okay, great. So we did. So I gave a whole talk about the mass revelation, fulfilled predictions, the survival of Am Yisrael, the survival of Orthodoxy. One thing interestingly that I talked about is that something that I love talking about, that there's a precedent in the Gemara for every new issue that comes up. To me, that's nuts. One of the reasons why I love dealing with contemporary halacha is that it's crazy. Every new issue that comes up, you have a basis in the Gemara. Here, you fly. I'll give you an example. This week, I happen to be focusing on the international dateline halacha, and it's a whole big question. You know, when you fly, let's say you take off from Hong Kong. On a Sunday morning, you fly into Shabbos. Well, are you chayv in Shabbos? Well, the Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Lamed Gimel speaks about a katan who you'll forgive me, but he has his sa'aros coming on Shabbos. Now he's chayv del rice, not just chinuch. And he can join Shabbos in prayer. He is obligated to join Shabbos, even though at the beginning of Shabbos he wasn't chayv. So it's here. How do I know where I have that I'm chayav? My chayav is determined where I am in flight. The Gemara in Shabbos and Kuf Yud Chesed and Beis that we praise the person who starts Shabbos in Tveri and ends it in Tzipori. It's crazy. It's nuts how it's issue after issue that there's always a precedent in the Gemara for it. It's just, it's mind-boggling. How could that be? Why is that? So I'm just telling you, is that something that leads me? Also, I just share with you something else. Something that, again, a little out of the box, not your typical thing to say. Here, I think one of the most dramatic statistics that testifies to the Torah's effectiveness in today's world is the dramatically lower divorce rate in the Orthodox community. Dramatically lower. I have one of my classmates from YU. He was Dr. Yitzi Schechter, and he conducts serious psychological research sociological research on the Orthodox community. He found within the Orthodox community it's the divorce rate 8%. In the Hasidic world, 12% in the non-Hasidic Haredi and in the modern Orthodox world, 12%. Again, it's sad that it's that high, but when you compare it to the rest of the world, it's unbelievable. It is unreal. Yes, Tyler.
So what do we say to people who just claim, yeah, because it's embarrassing to get divorced in these communities, so they just, you know, they have a bad marriage, bad relationship, but they stay married?
My response to that is that within the modern Orthodox community, you don't have a stigma. Once upon a time, you did have 60, 70 years ago. There was a stigma against it, but you don't have this kind of a stigma to that lasts till today. I'll just give an example. This week I was speaking to a Chabad rabbi. You know, he was telling me, you know, he came to refer a get to me. So he said to me that he was telling me, you'll forgive me if it's a little indelicate. He said, you would not believe how many marriages there are. You'll forgive me for just that sexless marriages. Sexless. He's unbelievable. He's servicing people who are not religious. It's unbelievable. I said, I'm not surprised. It's the Gemara said, Raga Bokatzva, it's Gemara Nida. So you hear what I'm saying? So that's Bekitzer, my response. That's Bekitzer, my response. Okay. Now, so the question is like this: what's a good strategy that one should pursue in terms of presenting things proactively instead of just waiting reactively? So this one I'll share with you from Rabbi Yudin from Fairlawn, where he gave I asked him this question many years ago, and he said to me like this. He said that he thinks a good strategy is like this: don't necessarily go out there unless they've asked you, but don't necessarily just say, okay, this is what I'm out of nowhere, just to talk about emuna. But rather, when you're giving a Dvar Torah, then you sneak in the emuna in the Dvar Torah that you're doing. So for example, I gave in the handout, I have four examples that I'd like to go through with you, if it's okay with you. And let's start with number one. Good idea. Let's do it in order, actually. You see the handout that I gave you? Section B, right? So here we go. Here, while you're giving the Dvar Torah, right? Here you go. You can sneak in the Amunah points. So here's the Gemara and Shabbos, the famous Gemara and Shabbos over here on Peichet. I see we have a couple of Sfaradim on the call. You forgive me for my Ashkenaz pronunciation. I'm the rabbi of a Sfaradi congregation, but you'll forgive me. I'm going to go by the majority here. Looks to be, judging from the last names, you look like you're Ashkenaz. Look like the majority is Ashkenaz. Anyway, so here we go. Let's go to number one. Right? Okay. So that's a famous Gemara we all know. But do you know? But it's an interesting, what does the Meshech Chachma say about this? What does the Meshech Chachma say? How does he understand Kaf Aleim Har Kigigas? He understands it in a non-literal sense. And what's that? Kaf Aleim Har Kigigas means that it was so obvious. It was so obvious there was no challenge. There was no challenge. It was so obvious, and as if it was coerced on us. Ooh, and if it was coerced on us, and therefore if it was used as coerced on us, listen to what the Gemara says here. Arabacha Barchama, the famous, unbelievable. What a shocking statement made by Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, and it's shocking that the Gemara even quotes this. But it's just ferocious, a ferocious statement, ferocious pursuit of emes. Mikan modah rabo al raisa. Wow! So you can—it's a modah. You know, you can. It's an excuse. You can get out of a. You can get out of a chiyuv of Torah. We were coerced. But of course, what does Rava say over here? Rava responds, "Ah, hada kiblu b'miachashverish tichsiv kimu b'kiblu ayudim kiblu mashi kiblu kfar." So the way that I like to teach is like this: that there's a definite downside in there being an ironclad argument. There's a definite downside in having the evidence being absolutely clear, because then you don't have a choice. When you have a choice in Emuna, when it's not slam dunk, when you have to use your brain, you have to use your intuition, and you put your intuition together and say, whoa, this has got to be made to Hashem Ayitazot. that's the difference between Mamon Har Sinai and Purim. Mamon Har Sinai, we don't have a choice, and Hashem wants a relationship with us. Here, Sfaradim and Hasidim start Shabbos with Shir Hashirim. Hashem wants a relationship with us. So as so Hashem has, what kind of relationship is it with if it's coerced? That's not a relationship. But Megillas Esther, right? Where we have to think about it. We have to think, hey, one second, put this all together. Was this from Hashem? Was it not from Hashem? You put it all together. One second. How in the world did, of all the women in the world, was Esther the one that was chosen? How in the world was it that Mordechai was just in the right place, just in the right time, when to overhear Big Son and Zeresh? How in the world was just Davka at the moment when Achashverosh is walking into the palace, when Haman's trying to walk into the palace, that's when Achashverosh is reading about Mordechai saving his life. Just as Achashverosh is returning from the palace, that's when Haman falls on Esther's bed. Look at all these things together. He said, whoa, each one individually. Okay, I can understand. But put it all together? Someone's manipulating this. Someone's controlling this. And it's not just ancient events. It's not just ancient events. Modern events, too. You look at your study. Read. You know what one of the most spiritually uplifting books that I find? I forget the name. It's a very important book about Israel's most important. Let's see if I got his name over here. Okay, you'll forgive me for forgetting. If some of you can remind me, let me know. But in 1948, an excellent book on Israel's independence. What an unbelievable Benny Morris. There we go. Sorry about that, Benny Morris. What an unbelievable discussion of the UN vote on the establishment of Israel. Unbelievable. You look at how the odds were against the United Nations voting to establish a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael. You study about the Milchemet HaShechrur, how many things should have gone wrong. You know, and it's crazy. You say, how could this have happened? You know, you read 6 days of war, right? By Michael Oren. Also, whoa, so many things had to go right. You put it all together. That's already, you're making the choice. You're making the choice in the Emunah. It's not just something that it's so obvious, Mama Harsini, you see it right there. But rather, you put it all together and say, this doesn't make any sense, but you have a choice. It doesn't make any sense. How did all these things work out so well? It must be there's a guiding hand manipulating things. But that's a choice when you make it, because you could choose and say, oh, it's all a coincidence. It was all a coincidence. Same thing with creation of the world. You look at all these stupendous odds that were necessary to create for the world to come into existence. You could say, you know, it's all a coincidence. Or you put it all together and say, you choose and say, Meit Hashem Haitazot. Jacob, yeah.
Going back to one of the Rab's original questions about in terms of how do we know, like, Yiddishkeit is, you know, the MS, but and not that, like, Christianity, Islam. I'm just curious because, you know, I've been hearing these, like, the unbelievable Hashgachas Hashem in the world for the Jewish people. I'm just curious, like I've never, you know, been to a church or a mosque, or I'm just curious if they have this same, like, this dialogue, like that do they talk about like Hashgach and how God and whatever they believe in, like save them. And like, there's this same like aura that we have. I mean, I'm just curious if the Rav has any insight on that.
So, That you'll forgive me, but I really don't know. But I would share with you this. They certainly can't make here. If I'm going to skip ahead to number three, right? I think one of the strongest aspects that we have, and in my opinion, again, this is the way I look at it, these things. You know, feel welcome to disagree. That's one of the important things. Is that I want to emphasize this, and I think it's a good strategy to say this is the way. This is what speaks to me. This is what brings, you know. But so everybody has their own way of looking at it, and their own shir that they sing to Kadosh Baruch Hu, their own path in the Yam Suf, if you will. So I would say to you, like what I have in number three is taught here, Parshas Kisisa. Hinei Am Kshei Orefu. Boy, is there ever a statement? Ever a description that's the most perfect description of Am Yisrael, We are certainly we are a difficult people, right? We're going to read about the in the parts of the Medrash about they're on Yam Suf. We're in a disaster. They're four ketos, right? We're all arguing what four different groups are instead of banding together, just following whatever Moshe Rabbeinu says, right? But we're the same way today. In 1948, we also split up into Arba Kisos instead of just following the leader, the Haganah, the Palmach, the Lechi, Eitzel, right? We're split up into all these different groups, and nothing has changed. You need just a bag of potato chips. A lot of times you'll have four different hashkagas on it because we are an argumentative, contentious people. The Gemara says we're azin shibakala umos. Yeah. And I have here in the hand that I have to you, I quote to you two people who don't necessarily identify as religious. Amos Oz, a very famous Israeli author, right? He's explaining in a really excellent book called Startup Nation. You know, again, these are secular books. It's unbelievable. If you keep the Jewish eye in mind, you can get a lot of chizuk and emuna from it. Listen to what Amos says. Judaism in Israel has always cultivated a culture of doubt and argument, an open-ended game of interpretations, counter-interpretations, reinterpretations, opposing interpretations. From the beginning of existence of Jewish civilization is recognized by its argumentativeness. Coming to explain, these American CEOs come into Israel and they are shocked by that they are being challenged every 2 seconds. Every 2 seconds they're being challenged by all kinds of people at all levels, even the lowest levels. They're arguing. They never saw something like this, but that's Israeli culture because that's a Jewish culture. That's who we are. It's who we are, right? And Shimon Peres said the greatest Jewish contribution to the world is dissatisfaction, right? It's bad for the country's leaders, but it's very good for science and progress, right? So it's an unbelievable statement that Shimon Peres is saying here. He's saying we're the Amkshei Oref, but let's take it to the next level. We are the Amkshei Oref. They're affirming Amos Oz and Shimon Peres that we are the Amkshei Oref. Why is that important that we're the Amkshei Oref? Jacob, everybody. What's the advantage? Because as Rashi says in Netflix Parsha, that we are a taromes in every single machaneh. We're arguing all the time. We're not this docile people that were just convinced by Moshe Rabbeinu. We argue with them all the time. And you know why you could believe that? Because we're the same way today. But if you go to but Har Sinai, we weren't b'taromes. We're kiyishacha b'levacha. Why? Because we bought in. And if the most contentious, argumentative people have maintained this Mesorah of this national revelation, that we are the descendants of the national revelation, right? You hear what I'm saying, Jacob? So I think that makes our argument so much stronger. But I think, again, just to go back to our broader point here, is that you could teach this Emuna. Without people, congregants, and students realizing you're teaching Emunah, you're giving a shir on Amkshei Oref. They have a talk in Parshas Kisisa about Amkshei Oref, so you could use that and throw that in here to finish up with two more examples of this with number two. Look in source number two. This from last week, unbelievable Ramban. You all know this Ramban. The Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo, right? So the Ramban deals with a huge question. Why does Hashem make a huge miracle in every generation, right? Why doesn't he do that? So he says, because you know what? Instead of Hashem making the 10 makos in every generation, what he does is he gave it to us to say it over. Now, there's a lot you could talk about this Ramban. You could talk about Hashem's empowering us. I'll give Charlie Harari a lot of credit. I love what he says here in the introduction to one of his books. He writes, Hashem is an empowering God. That's very, very important, by the way, to get that across. It's very important that Hashem is empowering. It's very important to say that everything in the Torah is in our best interest. It's l'tov lach. It's for our good. And the restrictions in the Torah are for our benefit. Very important to get that across. Hashem empowers us. Hashem empowers us. Hashem makes us the, he will do the Ten Makos, will publicize the Ten Makos instead of his saying, we publicize this week Kriyas Yamsuf, instead of his doing Kriyas Yamsuf. But we can add to that something very important. And I think it's a very empowering message that to tell congregants and students, telling that the Torah has a companion volume. Can anybody know what I'm saying? What do I mean by that? That the Torah has a companion volume. What's a companion volume? Who's the Torah's companion volume? What's the answer? Anybody want to say what's the Torah's companion volume?
Am Yisrael.
That's correct. Shkach. That's correct. 100% right. We're the companion volume. Yeah? It's not just because the book says it. I once had a discussion with a student. Not just because the book says it. It's because there's a companion. There's a people with live tradition maintaining it. That's where Ramban is saying. Huge, huge idea. And also, who's saying it? You've probably heard this. Rav Yaakov Emden writes in his introduction to his Siddur. Greater than the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf and all the miracles in the Torah is our survival. And he wrote this, Rav Yaakov Emden wrote this in the time of the American Revolution in the 1770s, 1780s, right? Can you imagine what would he say today, seeing it 240 years later, what we've gone through and we're coming through thriving? It's unbelievable. Just unbelievable. And the facts, a greater miracle than the Ten Mak, than the Kriyas Yamsuf, is the fact that tomorrow morning we're going to be laying in the Kriyas Yamsuf. So I think that's the thing that's also a very important point of the Ramban. But again, it's not a slam dunk. It's not an ironclad argument. It's something that you have to think about. And there's an advantage to that. Hashem gives us a challenge. You know, the Gemara in Yoma on Samach Testament Bay is very important. Is that, you know, the Anshei Knesset Agdol are asking Hashem to be Mavatel, the Yetzirah, for Gilui Arayos. And, you know, and they see it doesn't work out. You know, all know the Gemara. But then they say, you know, Hashem, well, maybe you could tone it down. You know, the Yetzirah only should be for those who are mutter to us, right? So you know, the response is Palga Berukia Lo Yavi. You all know that. It's a huge concept, Palga Berukia Lo Yavi. Hashem makes a challenge. Hashem makes a challenge, and he wants a relationship, and Hashem makes a challenge, and Hashem makes a choice. No palga, no halfway. He creates us challenges for the Yetzirah, he gives us a challenge for Emunah, but at the end of the day, he makes this one much more than the Yetzirah, but he gives us answers that are pretty easy to be convinced with. I think again the religious point of view is much more convincing than the secular point of view. I think the secular point of view has to make much more leaps of faith than the religious point of view. I'll just end off with one last point with source number four. It's a Gemara Megillah you probably know. I have a take on it. Let's see if you buy it. The Gemara says like this: is that the Gemara wants to know how do we know that Esther is Baruch HaKodesh Nemar? How do we know that it was written Baruch HaKodesh? So you have great Tanaim give all kinds of answers. And quite frankly, and even not just quite frankly, even the Gemara says these answers are not particularly convincing. But then you have these later Amorayim that right at the end of the Gemara give an answer like this, right? Oh, because then you know what really shows you that Esther's in Baruch HaKodesh? The fact that it says, "V'mei aprim ha'ele lo yavru mitoch ha'yudim, v'zichron lo yosuf mizaram." That Purim will always be observed and will never be forgotten. Ooh, that's already very compelling. But the fact that it makes a prediction that the Jewish people are not going to be destroyed, that's a pretty bold prediction. Now, as you know, if you listen to financial news, you know that when predictions are made, by a financial analyst, what do they say? They're always hedging. Maybe, you know, what are your predictions for 2021? You know, they always, you know, maybe there'll be a 10% rise. We're thinking possibly. They're always hedging. That's right. You want to hedge. Why? Because you look mighty foolish if you're going to be if you're going to be steadfast in your prediction. And therefore it's stark. The fact that Megillas Esther, which records how the Jewish people narrowly escaped complete annihilation, predicts that the Jewish people are always going to exist. The Megillah itself records how the Sefer records how precarious Jewish survival is. And yet it says, despite this precariousness of its survival, the fact that so many people are out to get us, the fact that it makes this prediction that the Jewish people are always going to be around, Purim's always going to be around, the fact that they make this prediction is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And that seems the best proof for Esther being written Baruch HaKadosh. The question is, one, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi ben Dor Muskus, why didn't they give this, why they have to wait for Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Nachman bar Yitzchak? I think the answer is time. That as time goes along and we see these predictions being fulfilled, wow, that's already a tremendous chizuk. That's already Ruach HaKodesh. But again, the argument is much more effective as time goes along in Rav Yosef and Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak's time, as opposed to much earlier in Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir's time. The fact that we see today, you know, it's easier for us to be religious today, it's interesting, than let's say 70 years ago, conservative Judaism was in ascendancy. And people were thinking that Orthodoxy has no hope. And yet, look at this point, how it's turned around. Conservative Reform pretty much is falling apart. And we're the only ones, we're the only community that's thriving. It's remarkable. This is some of the derech that I have. You know, this is the way I try to, this is four examples of how I try to approach Rabbi to put into action Rabbi Yudin's idea of taking the Dvar Torah and sneaking in the Emunah in the Dvar Torah. But again, I leave it up to you to decide what's the best way to go. Okay, I've come for my presentation, and let's see if we got now any questions. I'm not running away. Okay. Yes. Let's go to Moshe. Yes.
I'm going to project a little bit here, but I know that in high school for myself, I was plagued with these kinds of questions.
Okay.
There wasn't really so much discussion about it in high school. And when I asked people, they did mention things that you mentioned, which is that you don't necessarily proactively entertain these discussions because you might be putting questions in people's heads that they didn't have beforehand, especially at a high school age, etc. So as a result, I felt like it was taboo and, you know, everyone's just okay. And everyone else isn't bothered by these. And I'm weird and, you know, my emunah is problematic or whatever. I felt like I didn't know what to do with these questions. So I'm wondering what is a better method in figuring and reaching this balance for people like me?
That's a great point. That's a very, very great point. So I think maybe the Rabbi Yudin idea, you know, to kind of sneak it in, or just to publicize the books, you know, like if you're, you know, to say, look, if you're interested in it, we can discuss it. And there's, you know, and just open and say, look, if somebody wants to discuss, you can in a Tanakh Shir or Chumash Shir, you can say, well, if somebody wants to discuss if people are interested in biblical archaeology or biblical criticism, I have a lot to say about that, and I'm interested to talk about it. I happen to be more proactive than most, but I see what you're saying. You're saying it's kind of like what we're saying. Oilim Omer, Oilim Lo Omer. There's a big downside in not saying it. I hear what you're saying. Very, 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 very good point. Very, very, very valid point. Jacob.
Yeah, just another question came to mind, bouncing off of Moshe. If I've learned anything, like from, let's say, Seder night, Pesach, we a theme of the whole night is that we're not afraid of questions because we have the MF. So I don't hear, like, why not to be proactive? And even, I feel like to give a full comprehensive presentation of, like, okay, yeah, maybe there are Apikorsis ideas involved, but like Yisrael, Sarisa Yim Elokim, the pasuk, but like to legitimize the struggle with Emunah, like what, and like Moshe was saying, it's so taboo, it's so like, you know, pushed under the rug. Why not like bring that out into, you know, into full vision, full landscape view, and to say it's okay that there's sveikos, obviously in davening you can't have sveikos in davening around the mami the Muna Shlema, but like that it's okay to have, you know, have sveikos. That's just question number one. Like why is it so taboo? Like why is there even a question, especially in our time, to why not just come full force with it? That's question number one.
But let me respond. Let me respond by asking a question to the group. But for those of you who haven't lost yet on the call, by a show of hands, how many of you think that we should be proactive? How many of you think that we should be proactive? How many of you think we should not be proactive? Wow. So you all think we should be proactive. Wow. Okay, Jeremy, you think we should be...
I don't think we should be proactive.
Yeah, we should not be proactive, despite what you just said.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I agree. I agree with the sentiment that most people don't struggle with it in the way that I did, and that it would be more confusing to them. I've spoken to a lot of people about this, and a lot of people have said to me, I would have had a much more difficult time learning about this in high school. And even now I'm not interested. I'm not bothered by these questions, and it would just be confusing to me. And I think that's a greater risk than someone like me who can ultimately eventually seek out answers, even if it's painful and disheartening. At the earlier stages than to make other people have more problems.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Let's get some more voices. Menachem, yes.
I was just wondering in terms of that, meaning everyone people talk about teaching like Machshava in a formal way in like high school, whatever, there's always the threat of like raising questions, causing like people to have like issues in Emunah who otherwise wouldn't. I'm just wondering, like, that's sort of like the fear if that like makes the jump. But like, is there anything proven that like these things won't just like fall by the wayside and it won't like register in like someone's mind? You say, oh, there's shadows in the moon, like it doesn't bother me. Or like, and for those kids it does bother them, like, okay, now they have something to work with.
Right. Right, but there's something else. I think, you know, people also have to be in a place where they're ready for the answers. You hear what I'm saying? That's a big thing. They have to be in a psychological place where they're ready to hear the answers. That's a big thing. That's no small point. They may not be. Now, that's the beauty of Ki Yishalcha Bincha. When they're asking already, it's important to. Is, you know, then already they're ready to hear answers. One thing also, by the way, I would tell you is that if you have a relationship of trust with the students, you know, and with congregants, you know, they can feel comfortable with you. They can feel safe with you to raise these questions. So I think that's one of the things, you know, if you hopefully it's not easy to do, but hopefully you could be successful in forging a relationship that they can feel comfortable and ask you, Rabbi, Do you ever have stakos in Emunah? Do you ever have any doubts? So, and you know, you'd be honest with them, give them an honest answer. And I think it goes a long way. You know, But again, I think the MS is totally with us. But I think, but you have to be, but if yeah, they should be safe. They should feel safe with you, Yoni. Yes.
Just, I don't know if this answers the question, but just what's the difference between, we talked about like having a shallow emunah. Also, what's the difference between like a shallow emunah and just having an emunah pshuta?
So that's a $1 million question. In a certain way, we're better off with emunah pshuta. You know, and one will, you know, some will say that's best off is emunah pshuta, right? But, and for some people, that's totally fine. You know, Moshe was already saying a lot of, you know, some people have a emunah pshuta and that's it. They don't need to, these people don't need this. They don't need a reason to believe. They don't need Rabbi Wiederblank's. Well, they need Rabbi Wiederblank's book. They always need, but they don't need necessarily, this book. But, I don't know, but I will say for me, I know, that personally that, getting involved, writing this book and getting involved with these issues and realizing I have to be able to get to give proper answers to students, getting involved with this, I think has helped me. It's kind of like with Gemara in the fourth parak in Brachos, you know, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai at deathbed tells to his Talmidim that, more Shemaiki, more Basav Adam, you know, the stipler understands it to mean that just like the bus of Adam is real, you feel is real, so too you realize that Hashem is real. So I think personally getting in this journey of my deep dive into Inyanei Emunah, I think it's strengthened me tremendously, not just that I have a Ma'or Shabba, that it's just an intuition, but that I say, hey, you know what? It really is true. It's funny. But that's a feeling that I get after reading this whole thing as, whoa, you know what? It really is true. Anyhow, that's my thought. But that's not for everybody. It depends on the person. But you're right. But some people really, I guess I did have a shallow emunah before this. But look, in this week's parashah, even by Shem Moshe Avdo, as opposed to here, it says by Yamein Ha'am, Ray says that we had emunah in back in parashah Shmos. So Rav Chanan Wasserman answers in his Kovetz Ma'amar, and he says that, well, what's the answer? That emunah is dynamic, it can grow. So hopefully it should grow. But on the other hand, some people, emunah pshuta works. I think it really depends on person to person. Yes, Jacob.
I have two questions. One's like an actual emunah question that I'm not sure about. The other one's just on this topic. When Rebbe says like we should be sneaking in emunah to Dvar Torah, like I understand if it's about like the scientific and the proofs type of stuff that should be like snuck in and not like outright. But shouldn't we always be like speaking about Hashem, like how He's involved in our life and like He loves us, He only has the best thing? Shouldn't we always be talking about that? Shouldn't be like that the main part of like all our Dvar Torahs and like instill that in our Talmidim and doesn't need to be snuck into Dvar Torahs?
I agree with that 100%. One of the criticisms that we have. That I've heard is machanchim is that when do we mention Hashem? When do we talk about Hashem? You know, you know what I'm saying? What you can go, you know, so, I remember someone criticized the yeshiva that I was at. You know, you can go for months without hearing Hashem's name being mentioned in shir. What's going on over here? So I remember that's a Talmud I heard. So I really try to take that to heart, and I think that, you know, I think Zach, I think you would say, in my shiur, I do try to mention, you know, in high school, I think I would say Hashem a lot. So I think that's I've taken that to heart. I don't know what you remember, but I certainly that's what I'm trying to do.
Sure. Okay. And in terms of the emunah question, so. Like in terms of like evil in the world, like I understand how like there could be evil from people like that, because like there's free will in the world and people, that's how the world has to exist. And sometimes people choose evil. That's not necessarily like Hashem. That's people making that mistake. But in terms of like natural disasters and birth defects and like volcanoes and hurricanes and people suffering from disease, like if Hashem's like all good, like this, I've heard like people asking, like atheists ask, like if Hashem's all good and all powerful, like, well, how is He all good and all powerful if there are these natural disasters in the world? And how do we deal with that type of question?
Okay. So I'm trying.
I don't know if that's longer for a longer topic, but
But as I said, you got to come up. You have to know 30-second El Regalaca's answer. So I'll give you an answer. I don't know if it'll work for us, but I don't know if it'll work for the atheist. You know, to say this is it's all in our best interest, and that we need accountability. We need accountability. We just do. We know accountability is in our best interest. We need to know that when sometimes we need punishment, and it's sometimes it's in our best interest to receive punishment. So you hear what I'm saying? Let's say with Corona, we it's a good say that it's accountability. And Hashem brings it about, brought it about because there was because we need it. We need accountability. Accountability is in our bed. The example I like to give to my students is that when my wife and I, when the kids were little, so we had to hire a babysitter. Even as a non-Jewish baby, we always insisted it should be someone religious. We wouldn't want to trust someone who's not religious with a baby. Why? Because who knows what they're going to do when they're not there. If they're religious, there's a sense of accountability to God. So I think sometimes we do actually, I think these natural disasters sometimes it just needs to happen sometimes. Now we've got Ba'avon Gili Arayos, Andro Lemosi Bolo. Because sometimes, you reap what you sow. But ultimately that's for our best interest. It may not be something, not be for our convenience, but our just convenience is not necessarily in our best interest. Maybe that's a 30-second answer. I don't know how good it is, but that's a major question. But let's say, and one thing, by the way, you could say is the Tanakh. That one thing I always emphasize to students is that the Tanakh doesn't shy away from it. The Gemara doesn't shy away from it. It asks it a lot. Okay. Anything else we wanted to talk about, or we're good?
All right. I want to thank you again, Rabbi Jachter. This was so enlightening. And you were, besides helping, I hope maybe a better teacher, you're definitely also mechazek my emuna. It's really a big schus that we have to have been able to have you. And I also think everyone, feels comfortable knowing there's someone out there like you that they could turn to for help in these matters. So really, thank you so, so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Thanks for the invitation. And thanks to all of you still here. And thanks to all the guys who joined us.
Thanks,
Kevin. That's welcome.
Thank you.